This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is Dr. Evan Kanter, past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound VA. Dr. Kanter, it's great to meet you, and welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up, why you decided to become a doc.
Well, I grew up in the New York area, and I went to medical school and graduate school here in Madison. It's really nice to be back visiting Madison. And I became a doctor and an activist through my influences in Madison. And I started out as a bench research scientist. I have a degree in neurobiology. And I studied learning and memory at the molecular level.
Wow.
Mechanisms of learning and memory. And I became interested in the difference between how traumatic memories are processed and encoded in the brain compared to non-traumatic memories. And that led me, when I went to medical school here eventually, to be interested in post-traumatic stress disorder and working with veterans. So I kind of came at it through a side door through my research interests. So now I work as a specialist in that area clinically, treating post-traumatic stress disorder in veterans at the VA hospital in Seattle.
And what's that like? I mean, what are your experiences there? What are you seeing?
Well, I treat veterans from all wars, from back from World War II, all the way down to the folks that are coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq today. So I see a lot of folks in their early 20s now coming back. And struggling with tremendous obstacles and difficulties. I think we do help a lot of people. We have a much greater understanding of PTSD and other mental health problems than we ever have, and we have some effective treatments that are available. But also there's always people that you can't help or can't help very much. So I struggle having to watch young people losing their jobs, losing their marriages, and coming back and not being able to hold it together and really falling apart.
Dr. Evan Kanter, what are some of the effective treatments for PTSD?
Well, I think we have both medications and psychotherapies that we've developed over the years. I mean, PTSD first emerged as an official diagnosis in the book, so to speak, in 1980, largely as a result of the political force of the Vietnam Veterans Movement itself. And so that cohort of veterans kind of forced the medical establishment to take a look at, they recognized that the same things were going on in as they looked at their buddies. The medical establishment was forced to really deal with it for the first time. We'd kind of dealt with it a little bit after each war for the last 150 years, back from the Civil War. We had irritable heart or soldier's heart. You had shell shock in World War I, combat neurosis in World War II. It was kind of swept under the rug each time because society was just not ready to deal with it. And only after the Vietnam War did it really get out in the open. And so we've had 30 years now to actually having this clinical entity has allowed us to do research and come up with some treatments. So we have different kind of therapies, prolonged exposure therapies, cognitive behavioral therapies.
What's prolonged exposure therapy?
It's a way of desensitizing people to the traumatic memories that they have to contend with. So in a very safe, controlled setting, you have people, you can do it orally, you can do it with writing, there are different ways, but it's a basically a way of desensitizing people to these terrible memories that haunt them. And the goal is really to reach a place where you are in control of your memories rather than the memories being in control of you.
So by prolonged exposure, you mean you have them write about, talk about the memory rather than keeping it
right,
submerged.
Repeatedly until they are desensitized to it. And a lot of times what happens is people stuff it and they keep everything inside and that doesn't go well. They also may do things like drink heavily. One of the main symptom clusters in PTSD is avoidance. So people do all kinds of things to avoid any of the memories. So in addition to something like drinking behavior, you might go out of your way to avoid crowds, dealing with other people in general. So often these people can be extremely isolated and socially detached. And we see more individuals with PTSD in our clinic in Seattle, in the Northwest, than any other in the system. And part of the reason for that is they're all hiding out in the woods in the Pacific Northwest. There are large numbers in Alaska.
And how do you get them off the woods into the hospital?
It's tough. And that's the same thing today. One of the toughest things of dealing with the 22-year-old with bad PTSD is getting them to come in the first place. So one of the big things that the military is dealing with, as well as the VA, is to reduce the stigma that's attached to mental illness and encouraging people to come in. So either they won't come in or they kind of bounce off. We'll see them once and then we may see them again in a year. It's very difficult. It's difficult to get a 20-year-old to see the doctor for any reason.
And doing it once is not going to have a great deal of therapeutic help, is it?
Right. These people really need to be engaged with treatment in a consistent way. And the hope is that we have something to offer now, as opposed to after the Vietnam War, where people didn't really know what it was. But in order to be successful, we need people to come in.
And do the symptoms sometimes get worse at the beginning because you're having them disgorge the memories, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. That can happen. At the initiation of treatment, you often see that. And with continued engagement, most people will then begin to get better. It's kind of like lancing an infected wound physically. It's going to really hurt like hell initially, but then it's going to heal and get better.
I'm speaking with Dr. Evan Cantor, past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound VA. We're talking about PTSD and other traumas from the Iraq War and Afghanistan War. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. You're listening to Progressive Radio. There are also high incidents of suicide, and how do you encounter that, or the people who are attempting suicide, or are those not your patients too?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's something that we're struggling to deal with in the VA system as a whole, as well as the Department of Defense. There have been really alarming increases in the rates of suicide, both in active duty military, in all the services, and in newly returned veterans as well. There's a 26% increase in suicide in young veterans in their 20s between 2005 and 2007. And for the last few years, the rate of suicide in the Army has gone up. It's set records in the last few years. It's associated with the stress of the long deployments and the multiple deployments. There's more likely to be suicide attempts the longer you're deployed and the more deployments that you have. And the whole system really there's quite a lot of paranoia really at the administrative level in dealing with this. And
what's that about?
Well, the VA has, that's what you see in the media. So the VA has rightfully tried to deal with this. They have set up a national suicide hotline. There are suicide prevention coordinators at every major VA facility now. There's all these documentation requirements, mandatory screenings. The difficulty with suicide is that clinically nobody knows what works. There is no evidence. It's very difficult to tell who's going to commit suicide and who's not. It's often a very impulsive act. There are risk factors, but when it comes down to any particular individual, we don't know what prevents suicide. So there's a lot of mandates now. You must do this. It almost feels like being in the military itself. You get decrees that come from headquarters, some of which may make no clinical sense, but you have to do them, and it actually, the burden of documentation can take away from the time that you can actually spend talking to the patient. So it's a very alarming and difficult issue now.
You said that sometimes it's an impulsive act, which strikes me as different from what you see in an older cohort, middle-aged people who attempt suicide or commit suicide. In my non-clinical experience, Right. It's at the end of a long train of wrestling with depression. It may be different for soldiers coming back.
It's a little different. The greatest rates of suicide are in elderly men, and that it is very different. And the rates of completed suicide is also greater in elderly men. But you're also talking, there are other major risk factors. You're talking about, the biggest risk factor is access to means. So you're talking about people who have access to a lot of firearms and are well trained in the use of firearms. That's the situation that we're swimming in right now.
Speaking with Dr. Evan Cantor, who is a staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound VA and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. The numbers are astonishing here with the Iraq War. Something like 30% of returning soldiers have PTSD. The number of soldiers on multiple deployments, which you were talking about, I saw a figure of 500,000, maybe higher than that right now. You have a line in a study that I read on this issue that from a psychiatric standpoint, after redeployment, I think this was someone who already has some mental health issues, after redeployment, they may never be able to come home again.
That's effectively true. One of the most difficult things I deal with clinically is the situation where I have to counsel somebody who wants to go back, and they may have all kinds of good reasons for wanting to go back. It's common that somebody will return from an initial deployment and they can have significant PTSD, but basically be functional. They'll be able to, especially with treatment, have a job, maintain their marriage and family. And then when people go back and they're re-exposed to trauma, they may return not being able to function at all. Often, people will function exceptionally well as soldiers. So somebody who can be instantly aggressive, very, very angry and aggressive in a moment's notice, may function very well as a soldier in the field, but that doesn't work very well with your family in your living room or in a workplace as a civilian. And so there are characteristics to having PTSD that can allow you to do pretty well. So these people feel like they're comfortable in that role. It may be all they really know at that young age, too. And so they have a lot of incentive and drive to go back and do it. And it's very hard for me to get them to listen to how damaging it may be, and that it's not that they won't function as a soldier. It's what's going to happen when they return eventually, and it's whether they can ever really function as a civilian.
So you're saying, essentially, you know, you've got a patient there who's got like a small fracture, and if they go back, they're going to just have a shattering experience. And what do they say when you say you're going to have a shattering experience? You shouldn't go back.
They either get it, or they either don't get it really. They just have other compelling forces which are really great. So when you're in it at that level, you're fighting for the other soldiers that are around you. You have a connection to your unit, your military unit, and that's what you go into battle for the guy next to you. You don't go into battle for your commander even, or certainly not for some political notion. That's where their greatest ties are. So the intense comradeship that people have in the military, and especially if somebody's not functioning that well from a societal perspective, they're very, very tied to those relationships and that unit cohesion that they've been part of as a military force. And it's very compelling. Often they've had very sophisticated, high-level jobs that they've served in as a very young person, and they don't have a role that they can see. Certainly not in this economy, where they're struggling to get any kind of a job, and to get a job or not get a low-level job or be unemployed here versus to go back. Either in the military or to go back as a civilian contractor, they can often make a very good salary as a civilian contractor. Those people, unfortunately, are exposed to the same issues.
I mean, you got a hard sell then, yeah.
I have a very hard sell, yeah.
I mean, you can't offer them a job.
No. And so we see, they're really compelled to go back in other ways. And some of the contractor jobs are very compelling. They can go and they can support their family, making a very good wage. When we consider the costs of all this, we employ over 100,000 contractors, the Defense Department does. So there's almost as many private contractors as actual servicemen in the military. And though there are deaths and serious injuries and neuropsychiatric casualties in that population that we don't have much of a handle on at all, we know that more than 5,000 deaths have occurred in Iraq and Afghanistan in the Defense Department. There have been over 1,000 deaths of civilian contractors, and we know that because of people applying for death benefits from the Department of Labor.
Of screening that goes on with the military contractors, the employees of the military contractors, either when they're going in or when they're coming out, is nowhere like what happens if you're in the military.
Right.
Are really just falling through the cracks. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. No routine screening at all. There's a shortage of expertise in the civilian medical environment in terms of people that are trained to treat this kind of combat PTSD. There have been denials of PTSD claims by private insurance companies that have been documented. So there's a whole large group of people out there that are going to need to be served and are probably not being served very well at all.
Dr. Evan Cantor of Physicians for Social Responsibility is my guest today. He's a staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound VA. Still, we hear within the military itself that there's some commanders who just want to get their guys back into the field, even if they have some of these symptoms of PTSD. Is that another fight you're having?
Yeah, I think that's getting better. We have medical professionals, including mental health professionals, that are deployed well downrange, as they say, and there's a lot of advances within the military as well. I think we're stretched as a fighting force. Our military is terribly stretched, and so we are continuing to use and deploy people who are already somewhat impaired. People have probably heard that there are a fairly high percentage of people that are taking psychiatric medications, including antidepressants and other psychiatric medications, who are on active deployment. So there are people that are effectively being treated for PTSD, depression, substance abuse, and other conditions who are still out there. We are straining our people to beyond the limit.
Beyond the breaking point. Hmm. A unique industry injury from this war is traumatic brain injuries. And to what extent do you treat those, and what are you seeing?
Well, what we're probably seeing is we think of PTSD as being a hidden wound. It's really a brain injury, and it's a war wound, really no less than a shrapnel wound or other kind of wound. And mild traumatic brain injury may be another hidden wound. So every war has its signature wound. PTSD was kind of the wound of Vietnam. We're still seeing that, and probably in greater extent in these conflicts. And now we have this new wound, which is traumatic brain injury. So severe traumatic brain injury can be very devastating, up to being in a persistent vegetative state. There are equivalent numbers of people who are suffering brain injuries as PTSD. We're talking about hundreds of thousands. And what we're seeing is as a result of the blast injuries. So in these conflicts, 80% of the injuries are from blast exposures, from the improvised explosive devices and car bombs and such. And we put more and more armor on our people, and the insurgents, or whatever you want to call them, make bigger and bigger explosions. That's the battle that we're fighting. So we see people that are exposed, they're blown up, or they're exposed nearby to major explosions. This is a new thing, and we haven't dealt with it to this extent. There's something which we call a primary blast wave injury. And this is not a projectile injury. This is the atmospheric pressure from a large explosion. And so you can have a helmet on, and it doesn't protect you from a blast wave injury. And the neuropathology and the changes in the brain are very poorly understood as yet in terms of this. And we're seeing these in large numbers. We're seeing people repeatedly exposed to blasts. And the studies show that the impact accumulates. So you get a whole range of symptoms, including things like dizziness and headaches that you wouldn't see with PTSD. But you also see a lot of things that overlap with PTSD. Concentration problems, anxiety and depression, anger outbursts. Particularly anger, and you often see people that have both conditions. When you see somebody with anger problems from both PTSD and a traumatic brain injury, it can be extremely difficult to treat. And so the big question out there is, what is this going to look like in terms of the mild traumatic brain injury in hundreds of thousands of veterans? What is that going to mean, and in terms of providing medical care and disability benefits for these veterans going forward?
Speaking with Dr. Evan Cancer, staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound VA and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. I'm Matt Rothschild at the Progressive, and this is Progressive Radio. We only have about 3 minutes left, Dr. Cancer. And I'm wondering, you know, what needs to be done, both as far as funding and staffing for the VA, but also, I mean, bringing the wars to an end would be one answer, it seems to me.
I think bringing the wars to an end is the obvious answer. Many people just don't realize just how long these wars have been going on. We have these two conflicts that have been going on longer than any wars in American history. And the cost, the military cost and the social cost are greater, far greater than any war in history. So we've been fighting longer than World War II, longer than Vietnam. And one of the reasons that I'm talking about this from this perspective is that it turns out that one of the major costs of war is the health costs. And it turns out that the health costs, the major ones are providing medical care for veterans and providing disability benefits, both VA and Social Security disability benefits. Those costs are actually greater than the military operational costs of the war.
And they're hidden costs, too.
And they're often hidden. We don't hear about these, and we don't talk about them enough. And work by Linda Bilmes at Harvard and Joseph Stieglitz has documented these economic costs to a large extent. In 2007, when this was looked at, the military operational cost of the Iraq War at that point was $500 billion, and the projected long-term health costs were $660 billion. Both of those figures are now approaching $1 trillion. But the main point is that the long-term health costs are as great or greater than the usual military operational costs that we think of. So as a physician, I feel compelled to educate both the general public and our decision makers about this and demand that we need to take these costs into account when we make these decisions. And very clearly, when we made the decisions to become involved in these conflicts, we didn't talk about this and we didn't project the long-term costs. And we're not, and those dollar figures don't even include things like unemployment, divorce, family violence, and the tremendous longer and deeper social costs that we experience.
Yeah, and to say nothing of the heartbreaking human costs that you see every day in your practice, Dr. Evan Cancer. Thank you for being my guest today, Dr. Evan Cancer, past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility and a staff psychiatrist at the Puget Sound VA. It's been a pleasure meeting you and hearing about this crucial work you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella, an engineer at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.